This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Fred Pierce on the 2nd of October, 1999 at approximately 11:45 a.m. in Las Vegas, Nevada. So, Mr. Pierce, if you would, start by giving us a quick biographical description of yourself.
I was born in Saginaw, Michigan, 8th of October, 1932. My dad worked for the Forest Service, and in the ensuing 13 years, Mom and Dad moved 18 times, ending up in Southern California in 1942. We stayed in California, they did, for the rest of, for the next 45 years. I graduated high school in Pasadena in 1950. I had been accepted at Michigan State University, which was my dad's alma mater, and they also had police administration, which was my major. But being a land-grant college, I was required to take the first 2 years of ROTC and was highly recommended by the police administration department that you take all 4 years. So I went into college with that understanding. In the meantime, Korea broke out, and I wanted to serve my country, but I wanted to go ahead and serve it as a commissioned officer. I was commissioned on the 20th of August, 1954, and went on active duty 14 March, 1955 as a second lieutenant, infantry, Fort Benning, Georgia. While there, we heard various pitches on airborne, ranger, and aviation. And I thought, hey, if I can fly, that'll be great. If the Army will teach me, that's even better. So I went ahead and applied, was accepted, and went through fixed-wing school, started at Edward Geary Air Force Base, San Marcos, Texas, and took my advanced training at Fort Rucker, Alabama, graduating in July of 1956, and was assigned to the aviation unit at Fort Ord, California. While at Fort Ord, I met my wife. We were married there, and promptly got orders to go to Korea. She was pregnant for our first child, and so I waited for the birth, and then went to Korea for a year. Flew fixed wing, light, well, bird dogs, 01, L-19 in those days, but the 01 aircraft in Korea for a year. I was with a KMAG detachment up in one of the frontline corps, Rock Corps unit, our headquarters. And in addition to that, I was also the aviation advisor to the 3rd Rock Corps headquarters, aviation. Came back, that was in February of 1960. Promoted to captain. Assigned to Fort Knox, Kentucky. Went through the advanced course down there. And I was assigned to the 6th Cav Squadron first, and then went to the advanced course. Our daughter was born while I was in the advanced course. So we had one job before Korea and one after. And through the advanced course, was assigned to a ground assignment at Fort Irwin, California. Served as a headquarters company commander, tank company commander, and assistant S3 of the battalion, where I actually was acting S3. The S3 had health problems and had some surgery while I was there. Was there from there assigned to the 24th Aviation Battalion in Munich, Germany. Spent 2 years with the 24th, with a short interruption in between as troop commander of 2nd Squadron 9th Cavalry, the air cav troop in the 24th Division, and where I got my initial training in air cavalry. First initial doctrine and training, and it was all trial and error because none of us knew really too much about what we were doing. From there, I was called out of Germany, got orders on the 17th day of July of 1965 to report to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, not not later than 1 August without family for further reassignment to a restricted area overseas, Vietnam. Yes. When I received my orders, they were marked secret. I walked in the house and I said, honey, send the kids out to play. And I was home a day early. We were getting ready to move to Augsburg. I'd been reassigned as the S4 of the Aviation Battalion. She said, what is it? And I said, you're going home. She said, we are? And I said, no, you are. She said, oh, you're going to Vietnam. You can't hide things from an Army wife. So we went to Fort Campbell, formed an assault helicopter company, and within 2 months we were on board ship, 30th of September, sailed out onto the Golden Gate, headed on the USNS Buckner, headed for Vietnam. Three aviation units and the support command of the 1st Division.
What year was this?
It was the 30th of September, 1965. Served the entire year with the 128th. Assault Helicopter Company, 11th Aviation Battalion at Phu Lai. Flew missions mainly in 3 Corps, but also down in the Delta.
Okay. What did your training, do you feel your training prepared you for that particular assignment, that first assignment going to Vietnam?
Not initial training, but I had enough experience. We were very fortunate in that unit that the average flight time per pilot was in excess of 2,000 hours. We had 7 W-3s, senior aviators. I had about 2,500 hours of both fixed and right away. So what I lacked in Vietnam experience made up for in experience in flying. When we got in country, they gave us they infused us out into various units for in-country training. We had to get so many hours, and I don't remember, 10, 15, 20, something like that, 20 hours I guess it was. Flying with this other unit before we went back in and started flying our own unit missions. But as I say, we had the experience of flying as far as map reading, as far as formation flying, all of this we'd had. It was just a matter of we were operating in an extremely high density area and high temperature, which we had, some of us had. Our replacements coming out of Fort Rucker at that time had no load experience and no heat experience. And we sent through, but up through the aviation brigade, for goodness sakes, give them some load training before you go there in flight school. Because we were hauling pretty heavy loads right up at maximum. And with high temperatures and everything, it was, you were operating on the, right on the edge of the envelope, safely, but still, right on the end, on the edge. And of course, that's where experience paid off. The pilots that we got all turned out to be excellent over there, but it took a while to get them up to speed. The latter replacements we got were much better because they had some more training. Came back from Vietnam in. September of 66, was assigned to Fort Walters, Texas, Army Primary Helicopter School and Center, and was put into the Troop Brigade and assumed command of the Officer Student Company, which I commanded for about a year, a little over, a year and a half. We started expanding. I was in on the expansion. I formed a second officer student company. I moved up to battalion as executive officer, and then we formed 2 more officer companies, and ended up forming an officer student battalion, and I moved over to that battalion as the executive officer. Then from there was reassigned to Fort Hood, Texas, TDY, and wrote Hunter Army Airfield for Cobra transition. And in August of 1968, started putting together B Troop 2nd Squadron 17th Cavalry.
Okay.
At that time, was designated F Troop 15th Cav, and I still have the guide on.
F Troop guide on.
F Troop 15th Cavalry.
Oh, wow.
And then we were redesignated B Packet, 2nd Squadron, 17th Cavalry, 101st Airborne Division. And but we weren't allowed to wear any patches except the Corps patch. We were wearing the 3rd Corps patch there at Fort Hood. And when we deployed, in March of 1969 to Camp Eagle, which was in Way, right outside of Way, in the northern part of South Vietnam.
Let's take a step back real quick about concerning your first Vietnam experience. And more importantly, you mentioned the fact that when you got your orders, one of the first things you're obviously going to do is talk this over with your wife, what you have to do. And she intuitively knew that you were going to Vietnam. How aware were you and your wife and your fellow officers about what was going on in Vietnam? This is in 65, mid-65, so... What kind of information were you receiving? And did you realize that we'd built up so much advisory personnel there and so much of a commitment already that once the Gulf of Tonkin happens, we've got to start to pull
on? Oh, I knew what was going on. Yeah. Fully. Yeah. When I graduated in 62 from the advanced course, we were quite surprised there was only one out of our whole class who was assigned to Vietnam. Hmm. And he went over he had a public relations MOS.
Okay. Was Vietnam talked about during your training?
Oh, yes. Well, during the advanced course. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. We knew that what was going on over there. We knew that there was an advisory buildup. In fact, we had some of our students had been advisors. So we did discuss that. This was in 62.
Yeah.
61, 62.
What did they talk about in the advanced course? The former advisors, you remember?
The problems they had with the Vietnamese Army.
Anything else stand out?
That was the basic thing. I mean, you know, they'd be out on patrol and all of a sudden they'd be there all by themselves. Well, you know, they got up and gone in the night and decided they'd leave. Yeah. Well, I supported in 65, 66, we supported. We were a separate aviation battalion and we supported whoever we were told to that day. It came down from higher headquarters. So one day would be maybe the 1st Division, next day the 25th Division, the following day it might be the 173rd Airborne Brigade, the following the 101st, the following Arvin.
So as an assault helicopter company, what were the primary missions that you engaged in and your fellow pilots engaged in?
We, combat assaults, taking troops in or picking them up, resupplying them after they were in there, taking them in. Getting out of there wasn't too bad. It was the resupply. They got a little bit hairy at times.
How so?
Because we had no support, ship support. You were out there by yourself.
And what kind of weapon systems were on the Huey? Just the 60 gunners? Or
just two door gunners. One on each side. M60.
Can you relate some of the more interesting, hairier events?
Well, you never knew. I mean, I've taken several holes. I was fortunate. I didn't get shot up too bad. I mean, the ship didn't, but we did take some rounds at times. One day we were out flying, and I heard it go through there. You can hear it. I don't care. I mean, even with the wop, pop, pop, and your radio's going, and your headset, earplugs, and the whole works, you can still go. Went right up behind my head and between me and the crew chief behind me and up. And he said, well, sir, I guess that was the right place for it because it missed us both.
It didn't damage the aircraft very seriously.
Yeah, it just went up, just a hole up through the ceiling of the interior of the helicopter, missed the blades, missed the main rotor system, missed the whole works. Another one, I was leading a combat assault. We were on about our third, and we were out in an area east of Coochie, which is where the 25th Division was stationed. And round came through. We were on about our third insert, and a round came through the front windscreen, right up above there, going this way. and I took plexiglass in the arm. If I hadn't had my visor down, it would probably have been spent a good hour picking it out of my face, because that and the nuclear shield, was a big chunk of that ended up in the back of the aircraft, and I could hear it bouncing off my visor on my helmet. My co-pilot says, "Sir, I think I smell smoke." So we turned the lead of the, and we were low level at about 90 knots when it came through. So that was the end of our flying that day, or at least the crew. The rest of the company stayed on.
What was your biggest concern as a pilot during that first tour? What weapon system or what environment when going into contact, going into an operation?
After about the first three or four, you didn't even think about it. You were just doing your job, and it was a day-to-day, where are we going today, and what are we going to do, and you just didn't think about it. Well, let's hope it's not too, Charlie doesn't get too friendly. If he does, call in some support and see what happens. They developed an excellent chest protector that would stop a 50 caliber. Yes. It, of course, should give you a pretty sore chest, but it would stop it. In addition to that, we also wore flak jackets. Put the flak jacket over the chest protector so that we wouldn't get shrapnel. And no qualms about wearing it, I'll tell you. They developed an excellent seat. It also would stop 50. Okay. It was armored, and there was a sliding portion that would slide up to the right-hand side of, or the left-hand side, depending on what seat you were in. I got so I could fly the helicopter slow in the seat, because the seat hit, the armor didn't, just the seat inside it would move up and down. Drop them all the way down, all the way back. Got to fly that helicopter with no problem in that position. I'd never flown one that way before. I like to sit up and closer, but you learn. You hide as best you can. Just some once in a while, we knew we were going into a hot area, and the Marine Corps and the Navy and the Air Force did a good job of prepping. If it was really bad, sometimes we could call in our friendly artillery, which I could when I was with the captain. I had my artillery observer with me in my aircraft. But really, you just did your job.
What were the biggest challenges in creating B-Packet, what became B-True?
Probably making sure that the men were trained as best as they could be to do their job. And the better the man is trained, the more chance he has of coming back. And that was my mission, was to bring everyone back. I didn't succeed, but I had hoped to be able to. I knew that it was probably not, that was a wild dream, but due to the area we were going into, we found Hamburger Hill, so I mean, you probably read the, even though we didn't get the credit for it.
Did you feel that the soldiers being sent to you were top-notch, that they were being well-trained in their initial training, their basic, and then their MOS training, their AITs?
Yeah, they were good training. As we were talking earlier, some of them had gotten to the point where I had some goofballs, because they'd been weeded out earlier, and they were assigned to me. Well, I weeded out the bad, and we took the good. And the ones that I had turned out to be excellent. They were well trained, both in the technical and the infantry. And I had some squad leaders that had been to Vietnam before. I had some platoon sergeants that had been to Vietnam before. I had some pilots that had been to Vietnam before. This all helped.
You had been to Vietnam.
I had been to Vietnam. My executive officer had been to Vietnam. My operations officer had been to Vietnam. Two of my platoon leaders had been to Vietnam. So the scouts and the guns. We unfortunately lost our gun platoon leader just before we left the States due to health reasons. I think, as I remember, he had an ulcer that started bleeding. And then our maintenance people had all been over there. I mean, the NCOs and the warrant officers. So this was a big help. The first tour in the 128th, we didn't have but just two or three in the unit that had been to Vietnam before. Of course, they could help. They helped during our initial training phases, but it was a whole new ball game. When you got acres and acres and miles of nothing but jungle, there's no place to go. That aircraft's got to fly.
So you credit your success a lot of your unit's success with the combat experience of many of its officers and NCOs?
That plus good training. The training we gave them before they went over. And we didn't get corners.
Could you describe the organizational structure of the troop, the manpower and major unit breakdowns as far as groupings? I know I'm sorry to put you on the spot like that.
It's been 30 years. It was basically you had, there's your headquarters with the CO, XO, clerks, first sergeant, and an operations officer, and his operations sergeant, and an EM. And the operations being for both flight and operations, tactical operations.
Because you had both air assets and ground assets.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah. Then I had my air rifle platoon. They were lifted. They had the slick helicopters, the UH-1H model, to carry them. They were basically an infantry platoon, but it was ground reconnaissance is what they were doing. They weren't out there fighting as infantry. They had to, of course, at times. But they were out there basically for ground reconnaissance. You saw something, you didn't know what it was, you put your infantry in, they went and checked it out. And then we had our scout platoon, which had 10 aircraft, the OH-6, and they each had a pilot and a scout observer. He also had a machine gun the door. And then you had your weapons platoon, which had 9 Cobras. A crew chief for each aircraft, and a crew of 2. There was no crew chief that flew on those. You had a crew chief and a gunner on the Slick aircraft. Then in headquarters, we had two Slicks, my command and control aircraft. Had the integral radios that belonged in the aircraft. It was three radios, one FM, one UHF, and one VHF. And then in order to also have contact with squadron and with the artillery, Mr. Thompson came up with a neat little rack to fit in the aircraft that we could put 2 PRC-25s or whatever, the vehicular mounted radio. It's double stacked, plugged in, and they came up with that in less than 24 hours. When the guy that was going to do it said, well, I'd probably come up with that in about 3 weeks, he said, you got to tell them. And it worked. We ran the antennas along the skids and had tremendous. So I had the capability of using 5 radios at once. Now they could, I could monitor, and they set it up so that somebody sitting in the back, my artillery observer, could use his hand mic, but I could also key in from my position in the aircraft. Now that took we had some good electronics people. In addition to my troop, of course then I had my maintenance section of the troop. The 333rd Transportation Detachment, which was the third echelon aircraft maintenance detachment, was attached to the troop in direct support or attached. I think it was attached. Anyway, they all worked for me.
Well, what size was that attachment?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Frank Thompson.
Okay.
I don't remember.
Okay.
But it was one officer, one warrant officer, and
the rest were
one NCO and the rest were enlisted. The detachment NCO, the maintenance technician, and it was a major, called for a captain, and he went over and he immediately left the unit when we got to Vietnam, because I promised him, I said, you do a good job for me, and I said, I'll see that you get a company when you get over there. He wanted a maintenance company, and he got it. I didn't even have to. So, and he did an excellent job.
So, in terms of both men assigned and attached, what would you, can you approximate the strength of your troop?
A couple hundred, somewhere, give or take a few, maybe a few more. I really, that's gotten hazy.
Well, that's a good size unit.
Oh yeah, as they say, I had excellent officers, excellent in key positions. I had excellent NCOs, and I had excellent, very well trained enlisted men. Which made my job that much easier.
Now, when your second tour in Vietnam with B Troop, what were some of the more important experiences and engagements and operations that you guys did?
Well, unfortunately, as I said, I had got a case of dysentery, which hit me in May, and so I was in command in Vietnam just about 2 months was all. During that period, we're trying to get everything operational. Get the rotor blades back on the helicopters flying, back into a maintenance sequence again, so that they all wouldn't come into 100-hour inspections at the same time. We had to pull a complete periodic inspection, which was 100-hour, before leaving. Mr. Thompson ignored that, put him right back on the schedule that he had on before, so that we would phase him in and out. Squadron commander wanted to know why I had an aircraft and periodic. He says, you just got here a short time ago. Yes, sir. He said, well, didn't you pull them before you came over? I said, yep. I said, you want them all come down periodic the same day? He said, no. I said, well. End of that discussion. So, as far as any really significant, we had been sent down into a valley looking for some of the enemy, running an operation with the brigade when we were assigned to a division, and I'm not even sure exactly what it was. They were going out into the Ashaw Valley, one of the brigades, and they wanted an aircraft troop on standby for downed aircraft. To secure, be able to put the air rifle platoon in to secure an area of a crash helicopter with troops down or so forth. And so we spent a day out in the Ashaw Valley, and the next day I got dysentery. And it was that day that the troop found Hamburger Hill and got the division into one good firefight, and which was a complete complex of headquarters complex with all kinds of sophisticated gear in it. Very close to the Laotian border, or back right on the border almost. And of course, that got the division into a pretty good firefight. Unfortunately, they finished the firefight, backed off the hill, and Charlie took it over again.
What did you think of that? What, in terms of being an officer in charge of troops over there, and here's you have a much better understanding of the strategy being in place and being employed. What were your thoughts? What were your contemporaries' thoughts about this kind of a strategy? Go take this hill and then leave it and surrender it and let it be taken back over.
All my training up to that point, I've been told, you take the ground, you do the job that you're to do, you close with and decisively defeat the enemy. Period. That's the old armor doctrine. And I went back after a year in 65, 66, went back in 69, and we're still taking the same ground we were taking when I was there in 65, 66. And I said, this does not make sense. And of course, when an operation is being run by politicians halfway around the world that are calling the shots, and you're restricted by either political or a geographical boundary, there is no way you can win a war. When the ground commander's got to call Washington and say, well, I think we ought to bomb this. Well, we'll take a look. Well, no, not today. Or, well, if you get shot at, you can return fire. Now, when I was there the first tour, some of the best was when we were working with the Yanomamis. They said, you receive fire out of that village, you level it. Yes. It's on the Yanomami. We did one time. They burnt the entire village. We evacuated all the civilians and burnt the village. And boy, there was all kinds of secondary explosions. It's on a river, and it was a ammo and fuel dump. So, and they knew it, I'm sure. That was, but it is. It's a little bit demoralizing to go back in and take the same territory year after year after year and not do the job. And of course, the ground commander's hands were tied. So, what did you do? We didn't go over there to win the war, Thomas. We should have, because we were over there basically the good and the evil, the free enterprise country versus the communist socialist country. And as far as I'm concerned, those that are in Vietnam today, I'd love to go back, but I will not go back to Vietnam as long as the communists are in rule. It's against my grain. I still consider them my enemy.
No. When you went back the second time, this was after Tet 68, this was after Johnson made the decision not to run for re-election. What did you think about that? What did you think about Tet, and what did you think about Johnson's decision not to run? How did that affect you as an officer?
Well, it really didn't affect me. I mean, Tet, I was thankful I wasn't there, but by the same token, we should have seen it coming. Possibly some did, and it didn't get to the point where it should have to be disseminated properly. In fact, if we'd have kept right on pushing at that time, I think we'd have probably could have pushed ourselves all the way up. And of course, with a little bit of bombing early in some strategic places in North Vietnam, we could have probably ended the fighting soon. Granted, you don't want to purposely go out and kill innocent civilians, but by the same token, that innocent civilian can throw a grenade, strap a satchel charge or a grenade on a kid, and send them into a group of GIs and say, when you get in there, just pull this pin and give them a big surprise. They did that. A friend of mine, that was his first tour, he was a recon, ground recon, with the 173rd Airborne. They hit the ground, and there was a woman standing there in the field, and his platoon sergeant shot her. And he said, what'd you do that for? Walked over and he lifted up her blouse. She had a grenade in her hand. So this is the type of enemy that you're fighting. Air, sell you a Coke. Pull a ground glass. Dig tunnels and tie snakes in the roof. Now, I didn't see any of this, but I heard about it. And you get these warnings, be careful of. So, to me, we should have, after we kicked them their butts in Tet, finally, we should have continued. But we didn't, and it wasn't the ground troops. It wasn't the soldiers. And then it got to the point where it got more and more demoralizing, and morale was very hard to keep. I've talked to many unit commanders that had problems with morale. When I moved from the troop up to the 17th Group headquarters, and we had 30 company-sized units in the group, we got reports. Well, I knew what was going on. I was S1. personnel administration, and we were having problems with drugs, with whatever.
Racial tension?
Some.
Sure. Fraggings?
I don't think. I think that was after I left. I don't think we, or at least not in our group. I don't think we had any in the group that I can remember. And I had no qualms about walking anywhere in my troop area unarmed, the day or night. I had no problems with that. Because I knew they were going to take care of me. Because I was taking care of them. I learned back in ROTC, I had a captain tell me, he said, you take care of your troops. And he said, your troops will take care of you. Don't ever forget that.
What did you think of General Westmoreland and his decisions and things in particular, like, for instance, the emphasis placed on things like body counts and whatnot?
Well, that gets into a number. We should have been doing our job. And I was really, even though I wasn't too far from Saigon, that was, we were under the 1st Aviation Brigade, and then we were under, our battalion was under the brigade. And I was down the company, so you went to company, battalion, to brigade, then USRV, and then MACV. And he was way up, five echelons higher. I saw the man. That was because I was went to Bob Hope show. And Westmoreland was there. So I did see, but that was about the extent of it. As far as his philosophy, and I was too busy out there flying helicopters and trying to keep myself from getting shot. Keeping that aircraft in the air. But we had some old equipment when we went over there in 1965. We got the equipment that the 1st Cavalry was turned out.
Did you see a change from 65 to 69? Not obviously there was the big change, but I guess you were there during the transition from Westmoreland to Abrams.
Yeah, Abrams was CO.
So what did you see any transition as far as of that major change? Did the upper echelon have an effect on units like yours?
I was part of a division. All I was interested in was keeping my squadron commander happy, my brigade commander happy, because I was in direct support of one brigade. I had to keep him happy. And then the assistant division commander, who was out for operations, who was out, you know, nosing around all the time. He was an aviator, and he was rather demanding. He dropped in on you. One day he said, Major Pierce, how come you haven't found the enemy? I said, sir, we're trying. I wanted to get him into the biggest firefight possible. We did out there on Hamburger Hill. Finally.
So Hamburger Hill, and then you... with your dysentery, you moved up, after that incident, you moved up to S1?
Of the 17th Aviation Group. I was reassigned to, back to the 1st Aviation Brigade for reassignment.
Okay.
So I went back to brigade, down to brigade, and I walked in the G1, and I had gone to the advanced course together. So, I mean, and I knew him. That's what he got to offer George, and he said, well, how about... going down to the 1st, he said, you're out a little bit earlier than we planned on it, but he says, we'll sign you down to the 3rd Squadron, 17th Cav down on the Delta. And I said, well, what position? He said, well, special assistant to the CO. I said, well, all right. I said, then will I become the exec? And he said, no, the S3. And I said, I mean, I can go in there and be a hatchet man for the squadron commander if I'm going to be the exec, not the 3, because then I got to start working with the guy. I said, no, what else you got to offer? He said, how about S1 for 17th Group? I said, fine. Then he got accused of signing nothing but armor officers as the S1s of all the groups. And it was true, they all were.
And your primary responsibilities there were administration of the...
Actually, my primary duties were personnel.
Personnel.
Officer
okay.
personnel.
Okay.
I had an excellent NCO that handled the... enlisted personnel assignments, and I handle all the officer assignments, except field grade, and but all company grade and warrant. went through me across my desk. I made a tentative assignment, discussed it with the executive officer, and kind of go or no go.
Okay.
And normally, in fact, then I got to the point where I wasn't even coordinated with the exec. It was my choice, and I sent them, and I kept track. And as long as I kept the battalion commanders from screaming for help, and I had documented everything. I knew exactly where the people were, both enlisted and officers, and so there was no problem. And I briefed every day the incoming officers on what they would be expected to do, what units they were with, going to. First I gave them their assignment, and then we went into a briefing, an in-country briefing, the type of unit they would be going to. A couple of times I got some squawks from some Cobra-trained pilots that I had to put into assault helicopter companies, but I said, listen, you go down there, do the job for 6 months, put in sequester training, go on, or most of them didn't. But we had a few more that complained up through the command and came back down through channels, and I said, hey, we're short pilots, they're pilots. You want to double load the Cobra units, or do you want to have all of our units up to strength? That was the end of that comment. That was captain, air defense artillery, as my admin, or the adjutant. And he was excellent in the paperwork, and so he did all the paperwork. He was over there, so his records would show that he had served a tour in Vietnam. All of a sudden, the DA looked, and they had a bunch of these air defense artillery personnel that hadn't been to Vietnam yet. And, of course, they were falling behind. Most of them were West Point grads, regular army officers, one way or the other. They said, hey, you've got to at least have a tour. You're going to be competitive. Then they said, send them over and said, don't get them shot. They've got too much training. And I can see the Army's point. And he was an outstanding officer. Did a great job for me. And if I was gone for a day, either out inspecting or out assisting the battalions, or down attending once a month, they had the S1s get together at brigade headquarters. The brigade commander would have his group commanders in for a commander's call, and the S1s went along for an S1 so we could discuss personnel problems. And which was good, excellent. And so he'd fill in briefing on it. He did a good job too. Because I've sat in on his briefings. Get back early and slip in, and he always already started, so I just sit there and listen to him. First time that I didn't have to anymore.
What were the directives that, for instance, when you start off as B troop commander, your brigade and the squadron commander, what were their primary missions for you in the broad sense? You know, what did they want to make sure you accomplished?
Well, the squadron commander just said you're in direct support of this brigade, and whatever the brigade commander wants you to do until such time as we have a possible squadron mission, you do what he wants. So, and he took me to a brigade briefing. He and I went in and sat down on this operation that was going forward, and then I went back and briefed the troop. I coordinated daily with the Brigade 3, the S3, to find out what he wanted me to do. Well, I walked in one day, and he said, tomorrow, he said, I want you to put this kind of a team here, and this kind of a team here, and this kind of a team here. And I said, wait a minute, Major. I said, you come down and sign the morning report, and you put the green tabs on your shoulder. I said, you make the decisions. Until that day, give me the mission, and I'll decide what I'm going to use. And boy, it just got dead cold silence in that talk. And the S3, or the 2, who was also a major, is going like, kind of like this. And he said, okay. He said, I want you to cover this area. I said, fine. And as I was walking out, the 2 said, listen, when you're running your your teams back and forth. He said, how about checking this area out for me? And I said, sure, be glad to. And from that day on, we had no problems. He just gave me the mission. I said, give me a mission order and I'll do it. If and when I can't do it and don't do it to the satisfaction, then you have your proper ways to go through your brigade commander to the squadron commander back to me, and it will be taken care of.
I don't believe in the staff officer telling me how to run my unit.
So it was very flexible for you.
Oh, it was.
Well, it's a flexible type of unit. I mean, you've got your gunships, and you've got your scout aircraft, and your scouts are out there looking for the enemy, and consequently they get shot down quite often because they're low. You can't see it 3,000 feet. You have to be right on treetops. But by the same token, if they took fire, there was a cobra going like this almost immediately. You better get out of the way because he's going to shoot. And of course, the standard thing over there, when you took fire, you dropped a grenade, smoke grenade, which then gave you a pretty good idea where it was. I know during the first tour, occasionally they'd mark an LZ in a difficult area. I mean, you got a lot of rice paddies. Which one do you want them? Want to say drop a grenade, and Charlie would do it, drop the same grenade, same color.
Did it happen often?
It was more as the year went on, depending on the area. We didn't work in the trees because as much as it did down in the rice paddies.
What other experiences from Vietnam do you think were important, significant?
For me?
Yes, sir.
Well, you from day one in your training, as you well know, being an ROTC graduate, you're taught that your job is to, if called upon, to protect your country. And I feel very strongly towards that. As I say, the war broke out in Korea in 1950, and I had already been accepted to college. I knew it was a land-grant college. I knew I was going into ROTC. So, fine, I would much rather go as a commissioned officer. In fact, had I, say, dropped out of college and been drafted, I would have applied for OCS. That's how strongly I felt about it. So one way or the other, I was going to get a commission. And then I was going to serve. I knew that. It wasn't a matter of if, it was when. So, and I think you always look forward to, although you, in a way, not, well, you mentioned you missed Desert Storm. And I missed Korea, because by the time I got my commission, Korea, the fighting was over with. I did go over, but it was still not the safest place in the world to be, but it was a lot safer than it was in the 50s, early 50s. But you wonder, how will I react getting shot at? Has my training helped me? Has it not? Am I trained well enough to lead men in combat? Am I got them trained enough so that we take minimum casualties, which is always the commander's thought, or should be. Not necessarily so, but should be. As far as helping me, I don't know. It just mature immediately. You start getting shot at, believe me. I mean, these young men you took over, they were 18, 19, 17 years old, and they came back as men. They weren't boys anymore. Some of them were affected differently than others. Some of them had problems, no doubt about it. I guess due to my maturity and my belief in the Lord Jesus Christ, my personal Savior, I know that He has a time for me to go, and if it happens to be in combat, well, so be it. But I'm not a fatalist. I mean, I don't believe in taking chances. There's just so much protection you can get. I did wear my chest protector, and I wore my black jacket, and I took I didn't take unnecessary chances. But there were times on missions that you had no choice but to go the extremes. I prided myself on the way I, my flying ability, and I'm sure that that saved me more than once. In fact, I know it saved me more than once. And every now and then they'd get me to try something to, like when I was over there the first tour, and the river rats were just coming in, and they were part of the 9th Division, and they were river patrols, and they were out on some of the islands looking, and they wanted to resupply them. There was no place to, you know, they went in by boat, and there was no way they'd get put them by boat, or so they got the wild idea of using rubber rafts, put the supplies in the rubber rafts, and then sling them underneath the helicopter, and well, I blew the roof off of Vietnamese hooch, picking this up out of this pond to see if it would work. Well, it about half filled with water, and it was really, I was really pulling when I picked it up. They built a frame so it wouldn't bend in the middle, mm-hmm. and kind of blew the, oh my goodness, he says, my gosh, sir, we just blew the roof off that hooch down there. We never did that anymore. It was tried, and I kind of went back and said, well, it depends on who the pilot is and what the aircraft is. If you're going to do that, I said, I wouldn't recommend just putting anybody on that mission. But those are the things that you learn from. And I was glad when the tour was over. I had a wife and two children, and I wanted to go home to them. But by the same token, it wasn't my choice. I was sent over. I knew I was going back for a second tour. I wore the wings of an aviator, and I took that volunteer to be a pilot for the Army. I could have gone to myself at any time. I mean, lost my wings and not gone, but I go in another position. So. I'd rather fly. That was what I was, trained to do, and I did it.
What did you think about Nixon's program of Vietnamization? And you were back in the United States, I guess, when a lot of that program was really getting pushed, really getting underway, and the pull out of American forces was going on.
As far as I'm concerned, we deserted the Vietnamese. I mean, we should have done the job or not gone in the first place. And we were committed to protect them from the communists. What do? We pulled out and the communists took over. So as far as I'm concerned, we deserted the South Vietnamese. And it wasn't the military. And some of them blame the military. Well, it wasn't the military because the military's hands were tied. So...
What did you think about the rotation system? You just mentioned 65. Explain
65
again.
Was not good because at 65 our company went in and the majority of us stayed in the same unit for a year and then all went home at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you get in new people and they have no idea what's going on. They're just in from the States, mm-hmm. and it's like just bringing in a whole new company again. Mm-hmm. Later they got the idea of we'll bring a new unit in, but certain people will be transferred into other units, and we will bring people in that have been in country for anywhere from 4 to 8 months, mm-hmm. and so that it spreads out the rotation, mm-hmm. date of the personnel, and I think that was an excellent idea. Now, I was able, when I came in there in 69, to protect certain individuals, but only certain. So I kept my XO, my operations officer, my maintenance officer. I said, you can do the rest with what you need to. And they did. They took certain pilots and certain enlisted personnel and then transferred them into other units and brought in new people that have been in country. And then as they left, we got in new people. And it worked out much better than everybody leaving at once, which really stops operations for a while because you got an in-country training. You get a new aviator in that's
doesn't know the terrain, he's fresh out of flight school, he needs some experience riding with somebody else for a while till you can turn him loose and let him go out there in the, on top of the jungles for
and not get lost.
So big difference in your navigation. Close to the ground, miles and miles of jungle, then your nice roads and trees and farmland in the United States.
Well, do you think it's different for some units, some types of units, air cav, say, versus infantry? One of the criticisms in some scholarly works is that the 365-day rotation system and the rotation of either individual or small groups of individuals, especially into combat units, into ground units, that usually disrupted morale. You'd have those, you know, the competition, the FNG versus the guys that have been there for a while. The FNGs would sometimes be put in really precarious situations in some ground units. So were there drawbacks maybe to that system, depending upon the unit, or?
Well, it's up to the unit commander. If he, you know, if he's doing his job, he can ease that. He gets that new guy that just came in and he puts him with an older person and says, he's yours, you train him for in-country. And unfortunately that doesn't always happen. I mean, I've read quite a bit of military history and replacements were going into France in the Second World War, and the guys that didn't know zip from Shinola, and there they were, and they had the same problem in those days, integrating replacements into units. So it's been a challenge, but it's, and of course sometimes if it's heavy combat, you know, it's, you got to have the warm body, because you've had casualties, and you need replacements, or you've had people that reached the 365th day and they're gone. Of course, during the Second World War in Korea, it was duration. I don't know. I'm not so sure that it shouldn't have been duration in Vietnam. Gotten the job done, and then everybody... They didn't. They decided, well, morale will be better if they know that we're leaving in a year. And sometimes, they just locked on that date and tank with everything else. Others didn't. They... You had to pull them off to get down to the replacement station. Just depending on the person.
Do you think that was a mistake, not having a duration?
Well, we didn't. I don't think we went over there with the idea of winning the war. Not the military, but the politicians. I really don't think they ever. And look how Johnson got us into it.
A lot of things have been pointed out since the end of hostilities, and since Johnson's passed away, and so that was the Gulf of Tonkin incident really instituted by the North Vietnamese? We don't know. So, but we do know that there had the South Vietnamese were having problems with infiltration and with irregulars and with regular troops. You know that the Ho Chi Minh Trail down through Laos and Cambodia was pretty good size. There was lots of stuff being brought down. But I feel, and that was bombed and that was worked over, but it still, I feel, should have gone farther north, which we finally decided. Well, then there was the excuse of, well, there's foreign ships in Haiphong Harbor. Give them 10 days to get out. We're sealing the harbor. Blow all the docks. Bomb all the docks. Bomb the entryway. If there's any ships in there, sorry. It's too bad. Whether they were Russian, Chinese, or what. We were fighting a war with them, too. It was a Cold War, but it was still could have been a hot war at any time.
Well, what did you think about that fear? Because, of course, that was the justification given by politicians, by Johnson and others, was we can't go in and, for instance, bomb Haiphong Harbor because you've got Soviet and Chinese ships, you've got Soviet and Chinese personnel there, and we don't want this war to broaden, to include these other major powers.
10 days, 2 weeks, you get them out. And that can be done through diplomatic channels, and it didn't have to, and I know we didn't have diplomatic relations, but there was ways, we did have countries that could have gotten it, mm-hmm. 2 weeks, it would have gotten there, get them out, or we're going to bomb them. I don't care whether your ships are there or not.
Do you think that the fears of a broader war were unfounded? Do you think that if we had gone in and done, say, what you did, what you just said, you got this amount of time to get your people out, and we're going to bomb after that, and if you're there, oh well. Do you think that the fears that did exist, this might cause World War III or whatever?
I don't think so. I don't think it would. Yeah. Because I don't think Russia wanted a nuclear holocaust. Unfortunately, MacArthur was not given free hand in Korea in 1950. And it's escalated from that day on in Southeast Asia, or in Asia. And I feel that if he'd been given his free run to bomb across the Yellow River into China, where they were building up, that that would have come to a screeching halt a lot sooner, and we'd have had a lot less American lives lost. And I feel that the decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was a wise decision. It saved countless thousand lives on both sides. I had a roommate in college that was due to go from the Philippines on the first wave into Japan. Army grunt. He said, thank God we didn't have to go. Because after they surrendered, they still put the troops in the same exact place where they were going to go. He said, we'd have never made it alive. So, sure, innocent civilians were killed, but by the same token, it's war. And they would have bombed, if they'd have bombed us, it wouldn't have been civilians killed. So, I feel it goes back to that point, and it's escalated ever since.
To MacArthur. You actually agree with some of the theories and the philosophies that were going around the 1950s, we should go ahead and use nuclear weapons against the Chinese.
Well, if not nuclear, at least conventional across the aisle. As I say, you can't win a war if your military commander's hands are tied or restricted by a military or a geographical boundary. Mm-hmm. And he could not go across, or political, I mean, not military, but a political, mm-hmm. Or a geographical. Mm-hmm. He could not cross the Yellow River, but they could. Mm-hmm. And they could come south and go right back again. I'm sure some of our jets went over, but...
Well, speaking of borders, and I guess the important question of borders in the Vietnam War, what did you think about some of the Laotian operations, and do you know if B-Troop was involved in some of those cross-border operations into Laos, for instance, and stuff like that, or...
You know, there's all that jungle down there, it's awful hard to find the border.
There's not a nice line.
Nope. Yeah. I know I flew in Cambodia in 1965 or 66 sometime. They had a code word they used. And we were on a night operation, and all of a sudden on the emergency channel, which we monitored all the time, I heard this aircraft on the 350-degree radio, the Tonsu. VOR, you're flying into stormy weather, or you're in stormy weather. That was it. I said, cool. And we had, Decker? Navigation aid. I flipped it out. The pilot once had sat right up over the console, and with the light on at night, it blinded you. You just couldn't do it now. I flipped it on and looked, and I said, whoa. Hit a 180 and went back. We were looking for an area on the ground where a Vietnamese unit had gotten badly hit. We finally found it and went in. Made a night medevac out of there with 8 aircraft. Took back one to the bed, to the military hospital. To the Vietnamese military hospital.
On the bigger issues of Vietnam and how it fits into the American experience, what What do you think we should take away from that experience? What lessons should we have learned, or can we still learn from the Vietnam War?
Well, I think the biggest one is if you're going to get into an operation like that, do the job. Don't mess around with it. And, or don't do it at all. If you're called on by an ally to come in and help, do it. And do the job. Don't just go in halfway. Because they're still going to be your enemy when you leave. And we have enemies all over the world today. We've got, and I know we've got the Chinese trade and all that good stuff, but I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. Nor the North Vietnamese, nor the North Koreans. And I know I'm not so sure about the Russians. Now, most of your Eastern Bloc countries, yes, I think they were under Russian oppression and they've gotten them out of there. But the Russians themselves, I do not believe that they're not our enemies, that they're not our friendly. I may be wrong, but that's the way I look at it. And same thing with Castro in Cuba and Hassan, Saddam Hussein, and Iran. I mean, the Muslims are not friendly to us. Non-Muslims.
Okay, so one last question about
that's the way I look at it.
Okay. One last question.
I think we need to be vigilant as a country.
Do you see them? I guess the Muslims in particular, a lot of new Cold War scenarios, you know, try to identify who will be the next major enemy for the United States. And some focus on Asia, China. Others focus on Muslim countries. Do you think perhaps it is the Muslim countries that are...
Both of them?
Which one would you consider more dangerous? More threat?
Well, I think China, because they're who is furnishing equipment to all the rest of them. Selling it. Well, the Russians are too. I mean, let's face it, jets, nuclear knowledge, that's being stolen and sold. Because of the breakup and the military is not being, over there, is not being paid well. And they're stealing and they're selling, and if they can, it's kind of chaos by the sound of things and by the looks of things. And I think you probably gathered by now that I'm quite on the conservative side. And but I can't help it. And so I read periodicals and things that are on that side. You don't get it out of the TV unless you're on Fox Cable Network News or their network. And I don't have cable right now, but I'm certainly considering it for that reason. Our journalism is an all-gone slant, as far as I'm concerned. So,
Speaking of journalism, what did you think about the role of journalism in the Vietnam War?
I think it hurt. Greatly hurt us. This instant TV, you know, where in the Second World War, I mean, there was definite censorship, but there should have been. And there should have been in Vietnam, but there wasn't. And the same thing over in Desert. I mean, it can hurt you. It can hurt the troops. And then you get and of course, Vietnam was not a popular war. And then they show the battles going on 6 o'clock news, and you're getting anti-war rallies and no support. It demoralizes your troops. You get
so you think that the role of TV, the role of journalism generally, was detrimental
yes.
to the war effort?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Because of the effect it had on the populace mm-hmm. and the anti-war sentiment that we had to begin with. Mm-hmm. And just the mentality of some of our students and the And I'm not so sure that wasn't stirred up. You know, students are very, very easily led, shall we say. Impressionable. Easily led. It doesn't take much to stir up. One thing can lead to another, and the first thing you know, I was in college during the panty rape days. You know?
Panty rape.
Well, you see, they had men's dorms and women's dorms, right. And you know, and it was well. Anyway, mm-hmm. So I had to watch myself in the major that I was in, because if you had any strikes like that against you, forget it.
So, what did you think of O'Kara's piece, the piece of 73, early January 73?
I think it was wrong. It just gave South Vietnam back over to the North Vietnamese. It was just a matter of time when they rolled south, even though we'd worked with the South Vietnamese, when the amount of equipment that China had poured into North Vietnam, it was just a matter of time. And I don't think that the South Vietnamese had that strong leadership either. When they started south, I mean, they just bailed out and got out any way they could. And I can't say so blame them. I mean, they knew they were marked people. So, and we've made acquaintances with Vietnamese there. My wife, in fact, has assisted in English. She's a teacher. She was an elementary school teacher, and she volunteered to help work with Vietnamese on English as a second language. And we had some enjoyable times with some Vietnamese families, Cambodian, so forth. There's a lot of refugees came into the state of Washington. That was one of the areas that they allowed them in.
What about how the government takes care of its veterans from the Vietnam War? Do you think the government has done a good job of taking care of veterans since Vietnam?
No. I know. Not only Vietnam, but Desert Storm. I think they... It depends on the administration that's in. And they haven't done as good a job as could be done. I don't feel.
What do you think they should improve on?
Well, they poo-pooed the fact that Agent Orange has caused problems. They poo-pooed the fact that there have been some strange diseases in the veterans of Desert Storm. Instead of jumping in and trying to find out, try to push it under the carpet. Sweep it under the carpet. It did, at least it appears to me. Fortunately, my health has been good, with some minor exceptions. I mean, I've been working for the same place for almost 7 years, and I think I've missed 3 days of work because of sickness.
That's great.
And that was because my wife says, "You will stay home today. You're not going to work." I said, "I feel no, you're not." So I said, "Okay." But I've had excellent health. I've got a little hypertension, but other than that, I'm doing fine. Last physical, everything was fine, and I'm about to do for another one. And I don't know of any major problem. Oh, I've got some arthritis. Stuff like that comes on with age. So I was fortunate, and mentally I had my belief in my Christian doctrine, my Christian teaching, and I've had since Vietnam I've even had more, and I don't feel that shooting your enemy in combat is murder. In fact, the Bible has mistranslated. It's not thou shalt not kill, it's not thou shalt not murder. Under certain circumstances, killing is perfectly legitimate, i.e. execution. Texas does a pretty good job of that.
and I say right on every time. We need a little more of that in Washington. We do use it, but it's, and I think, well, I don't get me started on the mm-hmm. court system, mm-hmm. the legal system. But I feel that there are a lot more could have been done for the veterans. And I don't mean money-wise necessarily, but I mean just listening to and taking care of some of the needs of the veteran. You know, when I signed up the regular Army, they said, we'll take care of you the rest of your life. Wrong. I'm 67 years old. But we'll be next Friday. My 67th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. But I can't use a military hospital anymore.
Haven't for 2 years. Oh, you're 65, you're on Medicare. Out. In fact, before that,
TRICARE. Well, we're pretty filled up here, and I've been going for ever since I retired in 1976. So we went on with Group Health Cooperative in Washington, which has got an excellent plan. We have our health insurance through them, and so we pay a little more every month. But we have the ability to be treated anywhere in the world and by any doctor if our doctor does. But no more you getting the benefits that they promised you if you dedicated your life to the military and retired. So, and of course they lost my records too, and my wife's records, and Madigan. Yeah, well, can't find them. We wanted copies sent to our doctor. I don't know whether she just didn't want to or whether they actually filed them, and because we had been using them and they knew we were on. I can't send them off to the archive somewhere. I have no idea. As well, I don't have time to go up there and fight with them. But our doctor served a lot of the history on both of us for the last 22 years. But anyway, I feel now that the Veterans Administration has let some come down, although they were very good about taking care of my brother-in-law. Did an excellent job in the Second World War. That had some major health problems. We got him into a facility there. It was a state facility for veterans in Washington. They took excellent care of him. And the VA also furnished some of the support monetarily for his keeping.
You mentioned your faith a number of times today. Do you feel that the Vietnam War strengthened your faith?
Oh, yes. Charlie gets close to you, you get close to God. I mean it. Right now. You get about, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because I'm the meanest SOB in the valley. Still, you know he's with you. And it was many times that he was right there. As my co-pilot. Because there were some days there was no reason that I should come back. We won't get into all of those, but things got a little hairy at times.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I think I've probably pretty well rambled on long enough and covered enough.
Okay. This ends the interview one.